CKXU 88.3 FM Lethbridge presents True Contact, Resonating Reconciliation in Southern Alberta, Treaty 7, Blackfoot Territory, an audio documentary produced by Lauren Crazy Bull in solidarity with the National Campus and Community Radio Association. The grant for this documentary is a program of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the Department of Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development. We would like to thank our community partners, the Native American Students Association at the University of Lethbridge and Red Crow Community College. This documentary focuses on the legacy of Indian residential schools and their impact upon our communities. The content of this documentary may be triggering to some. If you or someone you know is in crisis as a result of a residential school experience, please call the 24-hour Indian Residential School Crisis Line at 1-866-925-4419.
Have you ever heard of a residential school?
Yes. Yes, I've heard of the residential schools.
Yes.
No.
Residential school? No, I haven't. I'm from a really small town.
Can you explain your knowledge of it?
It all dates way back to John A. Macdonald putting the railway through Canada and what to do with all of these Native American people that seem to trouble the whites.
Back in the 1800s, they started taking kids from First Nations homes.
Were put in schools by English government.
I believe it was ran by Catholics in Canada.
It was where Aboriginal children were removed from their families and put into schools, usually far away and kind of scattered about, in order to get the Indian out of them, as they said. I think that was actually in paperwork.
Taking the kids from their parents and trying to assimilate European culture into that of the natives.
First word that comes to mind is assimilation.
Assimilated.
Make them more white and assimilate them into the white culture.
To assimilate them to a Western culture.
And taken forcibly to schools where they were educated to be in white Christian values, so they weren't allowed to speak their own language or practice their own culture, and often there was sexual and physical abuse involved as well.
Mistreated and things like that.
Known for, I guess, mistreating ethnic minorities, especially like Aboriginals.
And it included abuses and all sorts of atrocities. Yeah.
Everybody set? I think this was their, the same thing here. This wall wasn't here. And this was like their rec area for the girls. This was all open here too. And the middle here is where the nuns and the priests were. I think they had their offices or they had their living quarters.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else all stayed here, even the supervisors.
And as soon as I turned six, Father LaFrance was the one that came to get me. My parents used to live in McGrath. And once my parents sent me to a residence, the father picked me up there and he brought me here. And I didn't see my parents for all that winter until summer break. That's what usually happens when you land up in residential school. You don't see family for a whole year.
Something that people, I think, are surprised to know about residential schools is that they closed very, very recently, that it was the last generation that was in them. And my dad was, I think, about five. And he was there till he was 16. And one day at Mass, Mass was about to start, and the nun woke him up and said, go wake up the father. He has to do Mass. So he got up out of bed, and he went down to the priest's office, and the priest's office is the first door on the left at what is now today Red Crow Community College. So he goes up on his tippy toes, and he's struggling to open the door. So I've gone there in my adult life, and I've looked at the doorway itself, and it's not even, the doorknob isn't even up to my hip. So my dad was a tiny, tiny kid struggling to open this door. But later on, as the stories came out, and you find out just what kind of awful was going in there, where these people who were spiritually, these nuns and priests who were spiritually, socially, sexually, emotionally immature people, having absolute power and control over a dehumanized group.
The sister that used to take care of us, junior boys, was pretty mean. And she used to really treat us bad. Even real, you know, now that you think about it, real stupid things too, she would take the switch to us. Just to see us cry or something like that. You know, it's a real, real mean lady. I think a lot of the boys that went to school here didn't know that nun. And me, the way I fight it is, once I got a job here, I used to be scared of the building until after I got used to it. And I just think to myself, well, why should I be scared of the ghosts? The only ones that I'd be scared of are the real people. What are they going to do here, the dead? So there's, you know, I hear things, you know, every now and then, or see shadows, but they don't bother me. If you let them bother you, they keep bugging you. That's the way I look at it. But we always hear a lot of stuff, you know, even you can hear people talking, but you can't make out what they're saying, but you can hear them talking. And that's just the old spirits around here. But yeah, I spent about 6 years here. But you know, there was some people that went through those meetings, residential school survivor meetings. A lot of people break down when they go through here. They've been here before. In certain parts of the building, I take them through and they just break down. Because of the bad experiences they went through in there. And I imagine it must have been pretty severe if they, you know, if they break down while going through a tour in there. I guess I'm just a little luckier that I didn't go, you know, I never got really severely abused except for getting the whip or stuff like that. It's a healing process. You know, I can just say I'm lucky I got a job here so I can deal with that part of my life, eh? Rather than trying to just suppress it and, you know, burst out every now and then, go in a drunk or something like that, and try and handle it that way. It doesn't work that way. Just got to pray a lot and keep your mind occupied. It's positive things. And, you know, if I was still in my negative thinking, stuff like that, I probably would have burnt the building down. You know, it's not the building's fault why stuff like that happened to me. It was the people that were running the building, that were running the school. Those are the ones I blame. It's not the school or the church.
They turned into college, they put up a lot of walls. And that's the back fire exit.
Hard, you know, being pulled away from your parents. And, you know, the way I look at it, it's like jail, eh? Like going to jail. You can't see family. That's how I felt like when I was in here. I think they got used to being in residence. And they got a taste of jail. You know, they used to be in a situation like that. That was when they were in residence. So when they got a little taste of jail, they land back up in there because they had to be there. They so used to going by the clock, wake up a certain time, you know, in the morning, you have to go to bed too. You know, in other words, you're always told what to do, eh? It's the same thing as in residence. You're told when to eat, you're told when to go to sleep, and stuff like that. And that's how it is in jail. I'm not saying that's, you know, that's what they're going through, but I pretty well think that's what happens. Eh?
I started my practice of law in southern Alberta, and mainly in Lethbridge, but servicing communities around Lethbridge like Cardston, Fort McLeod, Pincher Creek, Tabor. And as I started my practice, I was shocked by the realization of the number of First Nations people that were involved in the criminal justice system. And what I've learned through my practice and my personal experience is that the number of people involved in the criminal justice system from those communities is wholly and completely disproportional to their representation in the population. And my experience is that most of these people aren't people who are, you know, criminally inclined, but for the numerous social problems that they suffer from, including poverty, lack of opportunities on reserve, substance abuse, chronic substance abuse issues. So I'm talking about people that are involved in the criminal justice system, not people from that community, but a lot of the people that become involved in the criminal justice system do so because of problems with substance dependency. So they commit crimes while they're under the influence of substances. And so in terms of how those people have become involved in the criminal justice system, to my understanding from the stories I've heard and from the information I've been able to glean from clients and from other sources, many of those people either went to residential school themselves or they are the children of residential school survivors, and their lives have been very much impacted by the experiences that they had in residential school. So issues like, for example, sexual abuse often leads to chronic emotional problems throughout life, and oftentimes people who were sexually abused as young people have used substances in order to self-medicate or to mask the pain and the trauma that they've experienced. So later in life, when they are addicted and struggling with those issues, they can find themselves in conflict with the law. So those are in terms of my professional experience in criminal law. And then in the last 3 years, I've been working as a lawyer with claimants who are making claims against Canada for the abuse that they suffered in residential schools. So I've heard firsthand and been able to bear witness to testimony of actual survivors about their experiences in residential school. And I think that that has been completely one of the most amazing experiences of my life in terms of the knowledge that I've been able to gather from the personal stories. It's also very difficult emotionally oftentimes to hear the stories.
I raise my finger to the gospel slinger, typical misfit don't fit. Shh. They said you best get up and get on out. Nah,
what are your feelings on the relationship between the Aboriginal population and the rest of the community?
Indifferent.
I think it's getting a lot better these days, for sure. I think there's less stereotyping going on.
Divided.
Mixed land rights and stuff like that, right? That's more political stuff.
I think there's a lot of mocking of the Aboriginal culture, and there's still quite a bit of racism and a lack of knowledge.
I feel like people who have lived in the community for a long time seem to have tensions. They've already got their judgment kind of in their head.
Especially in Lethbridge. Lethbridge is a lot worse off than other places. Southern Alberta in general.
Because they're not seen in the populace so much, that there is this like assumption of difference.
I say they're kind of separated. They seem kind of just in their reserves, and they don't really blend with the rest of the population.
We only get a small taste, see them stumbling through the park and stuff like that, and not typically the good stuff of the community, like all the art.
For a lot of the Aboriginal community, there is issues with what happened in the past,
a lot of them grew up with those cars, right, from those days.
I'd say especially in Lethbridge, there's a very big disconnect. I grew up in northern Alberta in a primarily Indigenous community, and I was, like, I'm an immigrant to Canada as well, but I was there from, like, ages 8 till 12, but, you know, I was part of that culture, and it was introduced in the school, and it was just everything, it was very normal. But moving to Lethbridge after that and being in high school in Lethbridge was astonishing for me, because people would just be so nonchalant about discrimination and racism, especially against First Nations populations. So I think there's this really big disconnect where people have this kind of skewed view that's largely been reinforced by our media and all of these things about what it means to be Indigenous, what Indigenous culture is, and also the history of violence that I think plagues a lot of our Indigenous communities still. And as a result, people aren't very empathetic. They can't connect, so there's this huge disconnect.
There is this very, like, and it's not even kind of like a subdued racism. It's, like, very direct. Like, you walk down any street in downtown Lethbridge, and you'll hear somebody mention a Native American person in a negative way. Even if they're just, even if they're standing right next to them. And it's pretty horrific.
So I think that overall, like, my impression is that a lot of non-First Nation Canadian people don't even know about residential school. And I think it's very inadequately addressed within our educational system. And even the teachers who teach it don't know the truth, the whole truth.
From a completely personal standpoint, I mean, I'm trying to work through issues as well. I think the colonizer mentality is a really weird one, and it's one that I've been part of all my life. I mean, my German grandparents went to Guatemala in the 20s, and they basically started working on a coffee plantation that was a forest and land that was used by the Indigenous people there, and they were just cleared out by Norwegians and Germans, and who cut down all the trees and made tons of money off the wood and then planted coffee and quinine and made a ton of money off of that. And at no point in my growing up did they ever talk about the First Nations people there other than how beautiful their traditional dress was. So I'm Chris Demeanor, and I'm a sort of lifelong songwriter, poet, theater artist, and one of the most recent and ongoing projects I'm part of is sort of a Calgary cultural capital legacy project called Making Treaty 7, which is a really wide-reaching and wide-ranging piece that includes a number of both First Nations actors and people from sort of the non-First Nations community, along with consultation with numerous elders from all five of the nations that signed the 1877 treaty. And our goal is to take the 10 days of the treaty signing process and sort of break them down, let the public know, whether it's schools of children or theater audiences, let them know the details of what happened at the treaty signing, who was there, what was in the treaty itself, what was promised, what were the shortcomings, what wasn't delivered on, what were the misunderstandings in the translation of the treaty. So much of the project has to do with illuminating those things.
You said that Canada, it was a policy of education that the church carried out, like residential school. It was a government policy. At that time, it passed for justice. Obviously, it went through. If that were to go through today, would it still pass for justice?
I don't think they could do anything like that.
Even close to that?
No, I don't think they could.
Well, I'm in a unique position because I work with students and faculty and staff in particularly Native American studies. So I think we have a great relationship. I think there's all kinds of really exciting things going on. I'm involved in bringing some activities to Native Awareness Week, for example. So I actually think that there's lots of really, really positive things happening, and that we have a real opportunity to sort of change the story about that relationship.
Some of the aspects of the way children are educated today, for example, you have, like, my son, he's a First Nations student in that class, supposedly learning about residential school from a white teacher who doesn't even know the truth. And so you wonder, you know, the process of assimilation and all those things, it's still at play, yes. You know, within our educational system, because everything is still taught from that Eurocentric perspective.
But they cut your hair when you come here. Like I wore braids when I was young. They cut my braids off. And that's the part I didn't like. Some ways you benefit, and some ways you, I don't know, you want to fight back. But you can't fight back because you're too small. Eh? So you just go with the flow and listen. Makes the day go by easier.
Looking at the school itself, when they were doing renovations at St. Mary's to build the new high school, they had uncovered aborted fetuses that were, the priest had gotten the kids pregnant, and maybe even some of the nuns, but they aborted that and buried them on the grounds. And from what I understand, as well as within the walls of the school. So this was common throughout. There's a very, looking at the nature of the school itself, it's out in the middle of nowhere. The government was completely complicit in this. But not only that, you don't only have the Catholics in there, you have the Anglicans coming in to build St. Paul's. So there's the two competing of the same mind. They're fundamentally, you know, these Christian, you know, it's like the Coke and Diet Coke of Christianity at work, trying to separate the people and to get them to fight amongst themselves. The same strategy used in Ireland, to where we have the separation of North and South Ireland. You know, you get the people divided, you go in, you conquer, they're great, they're subjugated.
My mother, she came here, but my dad was in St. Paul's. My dad was Anglican. That's why St. Paul's is different.
Yeah.
It's Anglican church. My mom was Catholic, so she was here. But they both went to residence, but I don't think they stayed very long because they don't talk about it very much. Well, they didn't really talk about it that hardly. I don't know. They must have got it worse, or I don't know. Must have been worse in the olden days.
Well, what reconciliation meant to the Harper government, who offered a reconciliation, was a very ham-fisted "I'm sorry" in Parliament that he really just politically felt like he had to say. But when you look at, like, the payments that were doled out that I really didn't like, they asked our old people these questions. And like, one of the questions, from what I understand, was, did the priest ejaculate inside you, or did he pull out? If the priest ejaculated inside you, you get an extra $2,500. If he pulled out, you don't get that $2,500. So the questions were of that nature. And gauging the trauma and abuse that the person went through in residential school got them slightly more money, up to about $200,000. So you really have to lay out your trauma and your abuse and your suffering as a human and putting a tiny monetary price on that. Because, like, really, what are you going to... Like, you think about your abuses in your life, can you put a price on that? You know, can you put a price on the awful that you experienced? But that's exactly what they're asked to do. So reconciliation, to reconcile, on what terms?
Everybody takes, you know, everybody's got their own different experiences. Some of them got more, a little more severely abused than others. And I think the ones that got more, a little more severely abused, probably sexually abused, they're the ones that are in prison. They couldn't handle it. And this reconciliation, I don't know. They can apologize all they want, but that doesn't bring back the past.
After people do
learn what a residential school is and like the history and kind of how it connects to the way the Aboriginal community is right now. Do you think that will bring about change at all in communities like Lethbridge where racism is very prevalent?
That has to be the hope, you know. I think one has to continue on with their work to educate either through school or art or politics or documentary. They have to continue on with that work with that hope that it cracks open a couple of people and says and lets them know that and lets them connect. You hope that you do reach those few people that will say, yes, you know, the present state of things makes a lot of sense because of what happened now that I know this, and therefore I need, it's my sort of responsibility as an engaged or thinking person.
So just the mere fact of having this information out there, it'll give people, it'll cause them to think, and it won't be any, you know, there's no effort that is in vain. So likewise, there very well may be efforts out there now that are totally against whatever purposes this documentary is trying to gain. There's always an impact with whatever we do. This ripples out into the universe, into the world. It's there. So there will be people out there that are gaining in compassion and understanding for the topic and gaining in knowledge. So it's not in vain, and it's not complete indifference that we're fighting. It's ignorance and willful ignorance that will be attacked by this, and they'll have to sit back and think. We say, you know, contact happened hundreds of years ago. No, we're the first generation to speak English first. Contact only happened within the past 30 years. Like, that's where true contact is happening now, not then. And so it's our generation that is really making the first true contact between sides. And I believe that we are able to get more of the intention out, more of the history out. You know, that entire pyramid has to be flipped to where people are supporting each other and empowering each other. And I very much believe that can be done. I'm working on it. I'd like your help. But it can be done. Yeah? So, how do you feel about that?
As a producer for this documentary, I would like to thank the following people: Joel Norunner, Scott Fox, Chris Demeanor, Mel Dominiquez, Margaret Hines, Mark Argyle, Abby Morningbull, Ingrid Hess, Martin Heavyhead Jr., the Native American Students Association, Red Crow College, Red Jam Slam Society, Ghost Keeper and Wandering Tribe for the music, Benjamin Main and Sean Morgantine from CKXU. CKXU's Radio Society as a whole, anyone else who has contributed or shown interest in the project in any way. Finally, the National Campus and Community Radio Association. If you or someone you know is in crisis as a result of a residential school experience, please call the 24-hour Indian Residential School Crisis Line at 1-866-925-4419.